The first home buyer's grant was introduced by the Howard government in 2000 to try and offset the cost of the GST. And since then, it's been used by tens of thousands of young people buying their first home. But more and more state governments which fund the scheme now are making changes to those who are eligible and those who are not. In many cases, you'll only qualify if you're buying a new constructed home. Tonight, we're going to have a look at the property market generally, including what role these first home buyer schemes have had. Have they just pushed prices up or have they been a real benefit? To explore it, our guests are Patrick Bright, a Sydney buyer's agent who's written a number of books about investing in property. Great to see you again, Patrick.
Thanks, Tony. Great to see you.
And also with us tonight, David Airy, who's the president of the Real Estate Institute of Western Australia and a board member of the REI Australia. David, good evening.
Good evening, Tony. Good to be with you.
Looking back on 13 years since the first home owner's grant was introduced, David, I'll put it to you. I mean, do you think its overall impact has been positive, or has it just pushed property prices up a bit higher?
Well, its overall impact has been positive, Tony. There's no doubt about that. I think it's encouraged, on the positive side, it does encourage young people to save and purchase a property. That great Australian dream, I think, is still there amongst people. They want to get out of the rental cycle and get a little bit of a kick along from the government. At $7,000 is the federal grant, which is administered by the states, and most of the states have stamp duty concessions as well. It certainly did push prices up in 2008 with the boost scheme, where the grant was doubled, and in fact it was tripled if you were building a new home. So the result then was we had a massive rise in demand and sales and prices, and I think
I've had a friend who was selling real estate in Western Australia at that time, and they couldn't write the contracts quick enough, apparently.
Tony, there was nothing left. Prices in Western Australia, and I can speak from experience, were for the cheaper properties sort of $250,000-$300,000, and they were going out the door, but they were going up at $10,000 a week. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but it was a very successful grant, and I remember I was the national president in those days, and dealing with the federal minister for housing, Tanya Plibersek. Of course, they were delighted with the success of the scheme, but the upshot was that property prices went through the roof, and probably the lesson is that those big splash sort of grants don't really, they stimulate short-term activity. They're not good for overall long-term effect on the housing market.
Obviously, most state governments want activity in the building industry. They want people constructing apartments and constructing homes. Is this new move towards targeting people who are prepared to buy new homes working?
Well, Tony, in Western Australia, we've had an increase in construction. In fact, nationally, the building figures were up last week. Talking with the Housing Industry Association, they'd be pleased. But we still are underbuilding in Australia, given the growing population in WA, and there's an influx of about 1,500 people gross per week, netting down after natural increase. That's around 1,000 a week, and that's really putting the pressure on every aspect of Perth's metropolitan area. And to a similar extent, that's happening in the Northern Territory. Sydney's a gigantic city, by even in world terms, and certainly in Australian terms, it's enormous housing pressure there, and of course it's going to have to spread out further and further. We need to stimulate building, and I am probably one of the few estate agents that likes to talk positively about the building industry, and I say to people, they are not the enemy. They build our stock. We're the used house salespeople of Australia, and we need the building industry to prosper and thrive.
Patrick, are we short of stock at the moment? To be honest, there seems to be a lot of rental pressure that's building at the moment.
Yeah, well, I mean, all the statistics show that we are short on construction, as David alluded to there, and particularly in Sydney and WA are the two cities at the moment that have got the most rental pressure and the most pricing pressure statistically. So, yeah, we are certainly short of stock. But these vendor, I call them the first home vendor boost, really, because the money basically did inflate the price, and now they're inflating the purchase price of construction. So the money's really being passed straight on to the developer. Now, we do need construction. It is tough out there for the cost of construction. Labour's gone up, materials has gone up, land's gone up, all the taxes to build a property's gone up. So the ingredients of the overall project has gone up, yet the people obviously need help to buy that. But by what we've seen, and it's been broken down by a number of property analysts and commentators who research these things, where it has pushed the price along. As David said before, that it was, the prices were jumping up $10,000 in loose terms a week, to explain a point. But that was partly, I mean, that was market driven, supply and demand. Sure. But the grant didn't really help to put the fire out of that growth.
No, if I could just say there, and Patrick, nice to meet with you, Patrick, too. I've got you on the studio computer here. I can read about your books and I can see your face, although I'm sitting in the TARDIS booth. The what you said then, Patrick, was very true. Look, I remember in 08 and 09 when that boost was on, especially on the construction, some builders who are perhaps less than truthful with their prices immediately manipulated the prices upward to absorb the grant, which meant that it made no difference. Whereas we might say with used housing or established homes, as I should be calling it, the price is set by the vendor. The agent is purely the agent, whereas new building contracts were able to be manipulated, and there was a lot of that going on. I think the building industry, it would be very hard to control that. Again, if in the wisdom of some government they decided to throw a massive boosted building, I'm sure we'll get some talkback calls on that later from all those people who say, how dare a real estate agent accuse builders of being dishonest?
David, also, I'm wondering whether there is a different need in the community today. I was looking at some figures the other day that have just come out, which indicates that perhaps we're not aiming for the 2-3-bedroom home in the burbs as much as a unit in close to a rail or a train line or a bus line.
Well, the successful ingredients in property investment, and I'd be very keen to hear Patrick's comments here, because buyer's agents, I think, are very, very good at this. They work out where the buyers are likely to be attracted to, and one of them, in my experience, or several of them in my experience, are railway stations, transport, transport such as railway stations, shopping centres, infrastructure, and schools, and probably down the list a little bit is medical facilities. In other words, areas that are established or have those items ready to be established. Successful housing estates in this century require those ingredients before people will be attracted to them. They attract renters and they attract buyers, and they particularly attract people with families.
Yeah, Patrick, is it a move on for apartments over homes?
Well, my view on that is that we're seeing a bit of a squeeze here, because you've got to look at where the market's going and where it's been. And look, the old adage of land appreciates, building depreciates is true. However, supply and demand is what drives our market fundamentally. You've had when mum and dad, baby boomers, if you like, and their parents said, buy a house, forget the apartment, they were right back then. But times have changed. Baby boomers are now, and I'm helping a lot of them downsize. They're going from the big house with the gardens and the lawns and all the maintenance, because the kids have flown the coop. They want to downsize to apartments. Then you've got your generation X and Y. Some of them grew up in apartments, but a lot of them are having smaller families and they want inner city lifestyle, and they're living in apartments. So the demand is for that kind of stock. So, that is what a lot of pressure is on, is on the pricing.
Patrick, is the industry responding with the stock, or is it just pushing up the rental prices?
It's pushing up the rental prices, and they're trying to build the stock. The construction is trying to do it, but the cost of doing it, they've got to let one of the problems I speak with a lot of developers, and some of the problems they've shared with me, is that the cost of construction, you add the ingredients up, you put in the replacement cost of property. So you look at existing established property versus new, the premium they have to get for new property today with all the cost pressures of labour, materials, the taxes, which is the biggest thing, is killing them. It's like, some of them 20-25% in taxes, which weren't always there at that level, means the cost of a new property is so far above an established property. So it's hard to them. Then they want to build the property. They want to get pre-sales. You've got to sell off the plan to get their pre-sales, because the banks want to see them 50% plus sold before they start to build. They can't get the sales. The sales, because people are going, I'm not going to pay X dollars for this property because I can buy an established one for 150 grand less. You see, and that's the conundrum we've got. So what then happens is the supply is pulled up, rent rental demand is higher because people aren't buying because of the costs and there's a lack of stock, so supply and demand. The rents go up. That then pushes the yields up, which pushes the value up, and eventually the value catches up, and we have this construction boom, which we're about to probably start to see more so in Sydney and Perth. Melbourne had it a few years ago, and they've got a now what they call a bit of an oversupply of stock. And so this is what happens. This is the boom-bust cycle.
And David, how do you see it?
Yeah, well, look, I think Patrick's absolutely spot on there. The median rent on a typical three-bedroom home in Perth is now at $470 a week. That's up 22% in the last year.
Wow.
And for a two-bedroom apartment or what we call multi-residential dwellings, they're at $420 a week. So we've got, taking that out into the market, look, a one-bedroom unit you'd pay probably $300 a week for in Perth, and the sky's the limit as you get up into those more modern type of properties. And that's due to the growth of population putting enormous pressure on the rental market, and the lack of construction, as Patrick highlighted. Look, developers have found it pretty tough to borrow the money and get things off the ground since post the GFC, and particularly since the banks look at a lot of the projects that were conceived in the boom and conceived without proper, really, a lot of thought, I think. Mm. Just greed, you might say, conceived in greed. And the banks have had to handle the downturn at multi-million dollar losses in those sort of property developments. There's developments that I see around Australia and a few here in Perth that are now selling for, in fact, there was a feature on it just in the weekend, million-dollar units are selling now at $700,000 and $800,000. But the fact is they're actually selling now. But the developers are taking a hit on them. Many of them are bank-owned. That's put a lot of the lenders off lending for that. But if we don't start building and doing a bit of construction, we're really going to see this rental cycle get worse, and established home prices will increase. And I think what's happening is, and I wonder if Patrick agrees with this, they're increasing by default. 7 out of 10 people buying a home are choosing to buy an established home. And that's because of the cost differential, or the other factor is the speed with which you can buy an established home. You see it, you buy it, you settle, you move in. You've got to wait months and years potentially for a new dwelling.
Mm. So the other thing is, I do generally agree with that, but the other thing is that people are buying established properties because of the position that they're in, because they're established from the point of view of the near transport, they're near the schools, the hospitals, the restaurants, the cafes.
And they don't have a three-hour commute.
And they don't have an hour and a half to three-hour commute.
That's the lifestyle choice too, Patrick. We talked about the baby boomers before. That's one of me. Well, I'm one of them. You choose to live now because you're a bit older and more settled in your life, and you think, well, I want to live near all those things that I can walk to, and, you know, the library and the movies and all those things. And you can't take it away from the young people. They want to do that as well.
Yeah. Foreign investment in property had been something of a controversial topic in recent years. As part of the response to the GFC, the Rudd government allowed temporary residents to be able to buy real estate without gaining approval from the Foreign Investment Review Board. But that soon became a pretty hot potato, didn't it? Is the foreign investment in our real estate a bit of a problem?
Oh, I think so. I definitely think so. I mean, it did have an impact, and I think it's one of the things, along with the doubling of the grant post-GFC, when they relaxed these laws, did help contribute to our markets not feeling the downturn that they probably should have in 2009. And that was sort of kicked the can, if you like, a little bit further down to the following years, and it sort of spread it out. It's certainly a problem. One of the key laws that they relaxed, rules they relaxed too for developers, that you used to have to, when a developer would get FIRB approval to sell to non-residents and people who don't even have permanent residency or anything, it had to be brand new, you had to get approval.
Yeah.
The maximum you could sell was 50% of a development to non-residents.
Yes.
And 50% had to be sold to residents. One of the rules they changed was you could sell 100% of that development to non-residents to help stimulate construction. Well, what that did was that obviously caused prices, because developers, if they can sell the stock to non-residents, the amount of people around other parts of the world that would love to buy a piece of Australia is phenomenal. Our market held up better than most around the world, and it's considered a very stable economic environment and a stable political environment. And non-residents love to put money here whenever they can. And what it did is money did pour in here. And that just pushed prices up from supply and demand, putting it out of reach of the locals. Yeah. So we end up competing then. And one of the sad things when they did realise the mistake that they made with relaxing these rules is they actually didn't undo that one. They left that one. So new development can still be sold 100% overseas. And that means you're going to have 100% of that building rented as well, because they're not living here. They're not residents. They're overseas. So that's going to cause other social issues.
David, do you have a view?
Well, what you said, Patrick, is so right, and it just says exactly what I've often thought for many years, and that is governments come up with these ideas for political purposes because they look good and they sound great, but they don't think them through, or they don't get the right people to help them think them through. The reason that the package, the lid was on 50% of a new development was because if you allowed the whole lot to be sold overseas... Firstly, it didn't encourage local investment, but more often than not, the people that were buying them for overseas were not renting those properties out. They were keeping them purely for their own purposes, saying it was a place of residence. In Perth, I can tell you, we have 19,000, and it's as accurate as we can get, 19,000 unoccupied dwellings sitting there that are not rented and not for sale, because there have been apartments and things that have been sold to people overseas who don't want to incur capital gains tax, so they call it their principal place of residence. As a result, we've got a scheme that was changed again. The Foreign Investments Review Board were brought back into the picture, and the rules have tightened up again. But I think there's a lot of concern over farmland. Well, I know there's a lot of concern over rural properties and commercial properties being sold to overseas investors. I think that with newly built properties, it would help to stimulate the construction market, but we've just got to get the mix and the rules right first, because if the developers can't borrow the money to build the new construction, it wouldn't matter whether you're selling 50% or 150% overseas.
There was a report out this week that had Sydney as the third most expensive city in the world and Melbourne as the fifth most expensive city in the world. We're in a situation where, I guess because of real estate, you know, it's and Perth is obviously in the list as well.
Perth was the ninth.
Yeah.
So I don't know why I'm laughing.
Well, I mean, we are heading in a very strange direction, and people are... I guess, a bit nervous about jumping into a real estate market when things are expensive as they are, even though interest rates are low.
Well, I guess if you got Dr. Steve Keane on your program, Tony, he'd tell you that we're all headed for doom and gloom and the world's going to, Sydney's going to slide into the great abyss of Sydney Harbour. Look, I think we're long past worrying about that. The fact is we should be very happy that our economy is so good that... property prices have been maintained and they're in fact on the rise a couple of percent last year, and that's probably a very good sign. But it is difficult for people coming to settle into the country, for foreign people coming to live here, and it's very difficult even across borders. People moving interstate are horrified at prices when they come to Western Australia. It used to be that if you went to Sydney or Melbourne from here in the Antipodes, as they used to tell us, you couldn't afford to stay there for longer than a week. But, of course, it's just the opposite.
David, I hear that there are a lot of people who are the fly-in, fly-out, who now base themselves in Bali.
There's a lot in Bali. And, Tony, when I fly around, I see people on the plane who are fly-in, fly-out workers going back to New Zealand, Queensland. There's direct flights all over the country now that take them all over. I was in Broome on holidays just earlier this month, and there's workers fly out through Broome back to Bali, and in fact from Karratha as well. So there's all sorts of reasons why Australia's become this, almost for those workers, an investment haven.
Patrick, are we in a situation where first-home buyers are going to say, that's just way too expensive for me, I just can't afford it?
That's already happening. And my advice to them when I do sit down with them is say, look, invest where you can afford and rent where you're going to live. So don't be out of the market completely. Be in the market somewhere where you can afford to.
So in other words, at least get a foothold and then build from there.
Build from there, because it is cheaper to rent where you live generally in a capital city than it is to buy and pay it off. Mm. And there's plenty of smart places to invest. And even if you bought the same property you could afford to live in Sydney, so let's just pick a figure for $600,000 for an apartment, and that might be a first home buyer's home. it's actually cheaper for them to go and rent that apartment and actually like to somebody else and buy and rent themselves. And that way they're actually getting in the market and they'll actually eventually get ahead.
David, there are obviously, properties that are undervalued in the marketplace. I was watching a current affair show earlier tonight while I was at the gym, and they had this 27-year-old bloke who had 72 properties and was hoping to have 100 by the end of the year. And he was saying that he's not negative gearing, he's positive gearing. He's most of them are paying their own way. And, about $10 million tied up in real estate. And he's, according to the report, churning $200,000 a year doing it.
Well, of course, the successful ingredients there. He's young and he's prepared to take the risk, which good on him. I think he's putting his money where his mouth is. He'd be buying stock for yield, I would suggest, rather than for capital gain. Typically, spend $500,000 or let's say spend $400,000 on a property. You can probably pull a rent out of that of, well, depending on what it is, for even $500 a week. That's starting to become a reasonably good yield before ownership costs. You can borrow now, as we know, at probably under 6%. So the planets are aligning in that respect. That young fellow buying those properties would be getting a yield, and he's probably putting in, I'd suggest, at least 20 or 25% equity. Patrick can perhaps do the sums more easily on that. He certainly wouldn't be a 90% geared, and he wouldn't have mortgage insurance. I'd suggest he'd have the 80-20 rule as a minimum, and I think he'd be looking for modest capital gain. He'd look at the stats and he'd say, well, the market's been flat, but I'm going to get a gain over the next 4 or 5 or whatever years of average 4 or 5% a year. So it turns out to be a good investment. But Tony, you can't borrow money on anything else or secure money against anything else other than real estate ultimately. And that's why people like to own property, so they can secure their get a mortgage against the property and do other things.
Patrick, can you find positively geared property? Obviously you can. This guy has.
Well, you can, and you always will be able to. It just depends where you're prepared to go to buy it. And the other thing is that this positively geared property is a lot easier to find when rates are so low. Now, interest rates are at record lows. Let's think about where they are. I've averaged, I was reading a report, I think Mortgage Choice put out, over the last 20-odd years, they've averaged about 7.5%. If rates are at 7.5% now, I'd say that the majority of his positively geared property wouldn't be, and he's going to have a funding problem. So it might work short term. And look, I'd have to look at the whole portfolio of what he's doing to really analyse it, because I have seen some of these zero to hero kind of things, and I've read them in the magazine.
Go from zero to zero.
They've gone back to them. I've had people come to my office and say to me, look, I've got 10 properties. I bought these over the last couple of years. And I'm, scratching to pay for them and fund them. But they actually wouldn't tell most people that. They actually look like they're doing really well. They look great on the outside, but on the inside, they're really hemorrhaging. And they've got to actually keep going to keep the whole thing running, and they've got to keep doing transactions. So, unwinding some of that stuff. Sure, it can work. But
the stars have to be in alignment.
Yeah, and a lot of the time, people are starting with decent equity. They don't disclose that because it's not as doesn't sell as many sensationalised stories. So they don't always disclose that a lot of these people might have started with a few $100,000 in equity, because it's very hard. If you could buy, people come to me and say, I want to do that when they see those TV shows. I'll probably get some phone calls tomorrow because of the current affair show.
Yep.
And they'll say, "How I want to do that." And they go, "I want to buy some no money down properties and all these positive equity properties." I say, well, if they existed, let's just pretend they do for a second, and I could find a whole bunch of no money down properties, which you hear about, that sell these expensive property seminars. I said, how many do you think I could buy? Do you think I'd give you any if I could buy them for no money
down?
They don't exist. They never did, but they sell fancy expensive seminars. So people need to really take a grain of salt with all that.
Well, I'm glad you said that, Patrick. That is so true. The number of people who have come to me and told me that they're going to be millionaires next year, and goodness me, I think, no, you're not. You've just been sold a long course in how not to invest in real estate. The the safest way to invest in real estate is to save a deposit and try to avoid mortgage insurance, which means you need 20%. And if you're a young person listening to the program, get mum and dad or uncle, somebody to give you some equity or lend you something so you can get a bit of a reasonable deposit and then ideally pay it off. And you're never going to have a better opportunity. I've been in real estate over 30 years, and these rates are so attractive at the moment for a careful long-term borrower to invest in a property to either live in or to rent out and to pay it off and to build that equity. And I think that's the safe way to do it. We only have to look at our parents who probably only purchased, I don't know about yours, Tony, but certainly mine only ever bought one property in their life, and that was their biggest investment.
Yeah.
And that I think, is the lesson. The past always points to the future, and I think we should look at that and get our feedback
sure.
on the ground.
Yeah.
Always get rich quick scrapes don't work.
I have a rule with all my investor clients, and I project this to home buyers as well, but sometimes can be flexible depending on circumstances. It's the 20-25-20 rule, which is 20% deposit, no more than 25% of your income net in repayments. That's after tax.
Mm.
And you must be able to pay it off in 20 years. If you can't do that, you shouldn't be buying.
Yeah. I'm making a note, Patrick. That's a good one. I might use that.
What about negative gearing? A lot of people are critical of it, and saying that, you know, it actually keeps the real estate prices high, which I guess being in the market you probably don't mind. But they say that negative gearing is one of the things that, you know, assists the prices to remain.
I've read arguments for both sides. I've read plenty quite compelling arguments to say that it does and it doesn't. The one thing we do know, that if you do pull it out, as it was tried for about 18 months when Keating was in, that you stop investment, and the housing wait list blew out from months to many, many years, and they've never recovered for public housing. So, because it put a lot more pressure on that side of the market. So you do need
to... Hopefully they learned the lesson.
Yeah, well... So you do need some sort of investment. This negative gearing is part of our tax system. It's kind of part of our property culture. It would take a lot to change that. You'd have to give and take somewhere else. It's also available for the share market. It's there for other investment classes as well. So it's not something that's unique to property.
But Patrick, my view, and it's my personal view, and it's perhaps not necessarily shared by the Real Estate Institutes of Australia, but my view, I think, just in fairness and equity, negative gearing should be part of an investment plan, that maybe it's the first 2 or 3 or 5 years. The plan should be that the property or the investment will become positive. Otherwise, why would you buy it? People have this ridiculous notion, and they say to me, look, I've got it negatively geared and I'm getting a tax deduction of $2,000 a month. And I say, right, that's $24,000 a year. You must be hoping for a capital gain. Yes, but it doesn't matter. They've got this tax thing in their mind that they're going to get that back. To get the negative gearing that you've lost back, tax might only be 30 or 40 cents in the dollar. You've got to go to positivity at some stage. And I personally think that we might need some framework around that in future years, because it is an inequity to people who perhaps can't afford to get into the market, and prices are pushed up because of some of those investments.
But as you say, you know, 19,000 homes in Perth not being lived in at the moment, and probably in prime position.
Mm, and we've got a big problem like that in Sydney as well.
Mostly owned, Tony, and if we translated that across Australia, we could make that a 200,000 number, I suggest. And I think you'll find that they're owned by overseas investors living in close proximity to our shores, where the investment amount, be it $1 million, is a tiny amount in the context of the wealth of that individual. I know people in Dalkeith, or I don't know them, but I know of property in Dalkeith, which is a fairly expensive suburb here, with a median price of $2.5 million, where there are literally houses in a row owned by the same families that are not used, or used only once or twice a year. Now, fine, look, it's a free world, and they bought an estate in fee simple with a freehold title. They're entitled to do with it what they will. But we need to make the laws for taxation on property perhaps a little bit more amenable, to suggest that those people might be encouraged to put those properties back into the market and rent them to our growing and hungry rental market.
Yeah. If you would like to join us, we would love to hear from you tonight. Perhaps you have a thought. Maybe you are an interested investor in the property market. Perhaps you are looking to be a home buyer or an apartment buyer in the not-too-distant future, wondering exactly how to play it. David Airy is with us tonight. He's the president of the Real Estate Institute of Western Australia and a board director of the REI Australia. And also Patrick Bright, who is a property buyer's agent, is the best way of describing it. Yeah, Patrick Bright, EPS Property Search. If you would like to join us, love to hear from you.
Lines are now open.
Call 1300 800 222.
Sam Bailey had his life planned until the day of his car accident, which left him a paraplegic. He tells his story in the ABC book Head Over Heels, written with his wife Jenny. Sam conquered his disability through sheer tenacity and writes of their love story, telling how they met, married, and of their life together. Head Over Heels, available now from ABC shops, centres, shop online, and good bookshops.
Across Australia, it's Nightlife with Tony Delroy. Nightlife.
And it's 11 minutes, the latest ABC News. Patrick Bright with us tonight from EPS Property Search and David Airy, the president of the Real Estate Institute of WA. Johnny, you want a word about first home buyers situation?
Yeah, mate, how are you this evening?
G'day, Johnny. What's your circumstance?
I've got two things. I was looking to buy a brand new house. And the thing is, what you were saying before, it's actually cheaper to buy a already built house, second-hand house, you know what I mean? But the situation I'm in, if I buy a brand new house, I'm eligible for the first-term buyer's grant and stamp duty. But if I buy a second-hand house, I'm apparently not eligible for the first-term buyer's grant. Is that true?
Pretty much. Depends what state you're in, but that's pretty much
which state are you in, Johnny?
I'm in New South Wales.
Yeah, well, that's the case for New South Wales. So, yeah, what you need to work out, Johnny, is the new property that you're going to buy going to be, with the grants and the stamp duty concessions, still a lot more expensive than an established house? Because it can actually still be better off buying an established property over a brand new because of the inflated price of the new. The other thing you want to consider is if it's where that new property is it going to get good growth over the next decade? Is it going to be a supply and demand issue? Because a lot of these new developments, there's such a huge amount of supply. It could take 3, 4, 5 years before growth will start to actually show up.
Okay, no worries.
So in other words, if you buy a little closer in, sometimes it costs a little bit more, but because the services are there,
growth's going to tick over straight away. Yeah. You're not going to have to wait for the supply of the stock. The other thing I'm a bit of a fan of established property over new is because try and improve a brand new property.
Yep.
Pretty
add
tough.
Value. You can't
can't add value to it, right? So it's like you're better off getting, you can be better off, it might hurt your cash flow.
Yeah.
With buying a brand new property as opposed to, buying an established property over a brand new property. But if you can, you're generally going to be better off in most cases.
All right, good luck, mate. David, you want a word about capital gains and negative gearing?
Yes, Tony. Thanks for your program.
Thanks, David.
Much enjoy it. Look, I wanted to ask your guests. I just sort of think in Australia that we have an extremely favourable tax regime, capital gains and negative gearing for the investor. Now, as you said before, Tony, we've got Sydney third highest, Melbourne fifth highest property values in the world, and yet we live on the least populated continent. Now, to me, these tax oriented regimes they're making it spectacularly good for investors mostly, and that's what's keeping the first home buyers and so on and the ordinary punters out of the market. And I think, when we've got 22 million and the United States has got 320 million, and we're talking about trying to stimulate growth and in construction. Well, I think give the young blokes, young people, a bit of a hand. Stop this. I'm a baby boomer. I've had investment properties before. Stop this thing that rich investors are just sending the price through the roof.
Patrick, do you want to have a word?
Well, I sort of disagree a bit there, David. I don't think that the rich investors are doing that. I said the market conditions.
Two of us there, Patrick.
The market conditions are allowing it to happen, and it is the government rules that everyone's playing by. And if they don't tighten them up and make them a little bit more sensible and fairer across the board, then things like things where markets will grow, particularly with the overseas, if we change that alone, would have the biggest impact ever on our market if we just change the foreign investment review laws. The other thing about this most expensive cities in the world surveys, I disagree with them. I think they're a bit simplistic. I don't think they go deep enough. Sure, it isn't cheap to live in Sydney and Melbourne and Perth. I don't disagree with that, but I wouldn't put us in the top 10.
The thing I'd say, though, and I appreciate your comment, is that often in real estate, and I'd say the two guests you have, Tony, have got a vested interest in talking up the market, which you hear real estate people doing all the time. And one person said, maybe we should have had Stephen Keane. It was a bit tongue-in-cheek, but maybe you should, Tony, have Stephen Keane, because these two guys, nice guys, sound like it, but they have a vested interest in real estate properties going up in price.
No, David, it's David here.
I
don't agree with you in that respect. I think in my case, I'm the messenger for the property market, and I just deliver the statistics and the facts of the market. It matters not, and real estate agents are often wrongly accused of wanting to talk up the market. You've got to remember, we sell properties in boom and bust conditions. It's irrelevant whether the market's up or down. It's a healthy property market is a sign of a very good economy, and we should all be very grateful, because a falling property market, as the US, the people in the United States have seen, is disastrous for all sectors.
You talked before about when the first home buyer grant came in. You said yourself, or the other guest said, we could not sell them. You could not sort of hold on to them. They were going up $10,000 a month.
But that's the reality. That's just a comment.
That's the reality.
That was what was going on. We were chasing properties, trying to buy them for clients, and they were actually taking off quicker than you could save a deposit.
David, thanks very much for your view. Shane, you're wondering whether the foreign investors can buy Australian land. Is that fair?
Yeah, thanks, Tony. I'd love to ask Patrick or David, in regards to the Constitution, is it a legal process that actually foreign people are actually buying up Australian land?
They can, as long as they've got approval. Okay, so that's the main thing. They've got to have approval, and it depends on the size of the property that they buy, where the rules kick in. But generally, you're talking about $50+ million in farms and things where they need extra special approvals. But yeah, I don't agree with that at all. I'm very much personally against it. I'll declare right now, I've never bought a property for a non-resident. I refuse to, because I don't want to sell off the farm and make it harder.
Oh, good on you, Patrick. Good on you.
Yes, and I totally agree with that. I think we've got to be very careful with rural property in particular. In a small country, as our last speaker, as David was saying, about the country of 22 million people, and here we are selling off vast slabs of rural Australia, I find it very difficult to justify that.
Yeah, good on you, Shane. Thanks for asking. Ken, you're a baby boomer, and you're thinking about renting rather than buying.
Yeah, I'm wanting to downsize. And I'm finding, particularly in the inner city, a real lack of desirable property. So I'm wondering about permanently getting out of the ownership stakes and becoming a renter.
Yeah, not a bad idea, as long as you put the money you've got somewhere that you can draw upon it. And I've got some baby boomer clients who are doing that. Some of them are getting out of their bigger homes, and they're buying a place out of Sydney, and then they're having a rental in Sydney because they don't know how long they want to stay in Sydney. So rather than buy it and then have to sell it in 5 years' time and go through the in and out costs of that, it's going to be cheaper for them to rent.
Yeah.
So, and it gives you flexibility. You know, you might want a three-bedroom place. You might want a three-bedroom place now, but you might want to downsize that to a two. Well, it's pretty expensive to buy and sell real estate, you know, in a short period of time. So if you're not sure, just rent it.
Yes.
And they often say, if in doubt, do nothing. Bob, you want to make a comment on agricultural land being cheap for overseas buyers?
Yes. David and Patrick have touched on it. Yeah, I think they're nearly getting it for nothing in the sense that you wouldn't be able to clear, fence, erect buildings, put in water points and establish a fertiliser history. You know, like for wheat belt land in Western Australia, David would probably have an idea about that.
Well, I have. I've got a very active rural committee on the Real Estate Institute of Western Australia here, and if any of them are listening, and I'm sure they will, they'll probably ring me tomorrow and say, you're a mug, David, because they're quite happy to sell to anybody. But that's our real estate agents. But on the other hand, some of that land through the wheat belt, particularly bought in when it was bought in downturn conditions, when drought conditions, was just sold so cheaply. Big swathes of land which have gone overseas and often in many cases are not being properly managed subsequently or are not being used at all. And we touched earlier on unoccupied residential dwellings. There's a lot of unoccupied or abandoned farms which are in the hands of overseas owners that are not being used and are becoming, you might say, blight on the landscape.
David, thanks so much for being there tonight. I really appreciate your time. David Airy, President of the Real Estate Institute of WA, and also Patrick Bright from EPS Property Search. Great to catch up with you again, Patrick.
Good, thanks, Tony.